This is a podcast from Shooting People. Hello, this is Andy Conway, and welcome to a brand new Shooting Screenwriters podcast. This month I was talking to Australian writer-director Rolf De Heer about his new film, Ten Canoes, about his very interesting screenwriting methods, and his next film, Dr. Plonk. I started off, though, by asking Rolf where the idea for Ten Canoes came from.
I worked with the preeminent Australian Indigenous actor, David Gulpilil, on a film called The Tracker. And before we actually shot The Tracker, I went to visit David up on his tribal lands. And even then he was saying, you've got to come up here and make a film with my mob. And I said, no, we're doing The Tracker. And I spent a week or so up there, which was in some senses an extremely difficult week because it's extremely remote. It's culturally so different to anything I've experienced. I mean, when I first got there, it felt like the most foreign country I'd ever been to. And then I worked with David on The Tracker, and it was a very good experience. But, you know, managing David is a stressful job. It's quite stressful.
Why is that?
Well, David was plucked out of the bush at age 17 to make a film with Nicholas Roeg, Walkabout. And his first sort of acting mentor was a guy called John Mellion, who was quite well known in the 50s here and the 60s in Australia in particular. And John had the reputation of drinking 4 dozen beers during a working day. And he taught David how to act whilst drunk. This is like a 17-year-old kid out of the bush who can barely speak English. And that was his first experience with acting. You know, his first acting teacher was John Mellion. His second acting mentor was on his next film, which was Mad Dog Morgan. Lead role, Dennis Hopper. And so David is difficult to manage because that's how he thinks actors ought to behave. That's what he's been taught, effectively. And, you know, it was a great experience working with him on The Tracker. He's a wonderful, wonderful actor, and he's a friend, but stressful to manage. Anyway, even while we're shooting The Tracker, David would say, hey, come up to my country and, you know, we shoot Tracker 2. I said, no, David, we're shooting Tracker 1. And every time I saw him afterwards, which was every so now and then, you know, he would say, hey, when are you coming up and make a film with my mob? And, you know, I had been up there and I had worked with David and I had no intention of ever going up there to make a film. Then one day I was sort of musing idly about indigenously themed films, and there had been few and far between over the decades. And then in 2002 there was this whole sort of almost flowering of indigenously themed films. There was, you know, Rabbit Proof Fence and Beneath Clouds, which was directed by an Indigenous person. There was Australian Rules, there was The Tracker, there was Yolngu. You know, it was like there was lots of stuff happening. And then suddenly nothing. And so I was thinking, you know, where would one go next with this? And I thought, you know, I know what you would do. You would go up to David's country, not me, but, you know, that's what you would do. And he should co-direct it because he's got the knowledge. And he could communicate with his people. And it's a dry community, so, you know, that'd be sort of under control. You know, you would shoot it in their own language because, you know, none of them ever acted before apart from David. And that would be fantastic, you know, that would be a real, you know. But I thought, there's no way I'm going to do it. No way, no. And then a couple of days later, I worked out that the film I was trying to finance at the time, it was cast dependent, the budget was a bit bigger. I knew it would take me much longer to get financed than I'd expected. So I thought, oh, here we go again. I have to pull out something out of the hat fast, get it financed fast, little tiny low-budget thing of some sort, and, okay, what can I think of this time? But I couldn't think of anything because this thing was in my head about how to shoot a film up in David's tribal lands. And I thought, no, I'm going to sentence myself to that purgatory. And then I still couldn't think of anything else, and so I thought, what I have to do is I have to get rid of that idea out of my head. And what I'll do is I'll suggest it to Julie and Eric, who are my colleagues in my little production company. So I came in and I sort of lobbed this grenade into the middle of the office. How about we do this? Now, I know they had both suffered more than I had on the Tracker, you know. And so I thought it was on pretty safe grounds, and yeah, there was 10 seconds of deathly silence. Dear beauty. And then they both said, what a fantastic idea. And I went, oh, Jesus. Now I'm sentenced. And so, on the spot, I rang David. And 2 days later, I was up there. And we began to talk about what to do. And there was a group of other men with him. And, you know, we began to concoct something. And there was this sort of vague idea, it was very vague, of some sort of indigenous story. And then just before I left, David came in and said, we need 10 canoes. And I said, what? He said, we need 10 canoes. I said, what do we need 10 canoes for? The film? He said, yes. I said, David, you know, we don't even know what the story is. How can we need 10 canoes? He's got this battered, blue, dusty plastic folder, and he opens it up and he puts it in front of me. And there's a photo taken in 1937 by Donald Thompson, the anthropologist, and it's 10 men standing on their canoes in the swamp. I take one look at it, I look up at Dave and I said, you're right, we need 10 canoes, because it was such a cinematic image. And it spoke of a world, you know, that if we could go there, it would be an extraordinary journey. It would potentially make an extraordinary film. And so then I left and went to Sydney and got the film financed. Anyway, by the time I went back there, they had independently gone down the same road. They then began to say, look, you know, we want goose egg hunting in it. You know, we want to set it all in old times. We want storytelling in it. That's how the film became what it became in the format that it's in. Okay, there are these Thompson photographs which are, well, they're revered up there, because they are like ancestral links, because the individuals in those photos have been identified and everybody is related to somebody in those photos. And they have had them in black and white, and that's what they are. You know, that's history. And so I thought, oh God, you know, it'd be great to shoot this film in black and white. It'd just be great. But I can't, because I'm contracted, you know, to deliver a film in colour. And it's an obscure enough thing to do, is to shoot a film in indigenous language, in a language that perhaps only 200 people can speak. That was one issue. I wanted to sort of honour the photos for them. They sort of idealised old times, but they didn't want the old times depicted as a time of conflict. And so, you know, I've got all these problems, you know, all these issues. The main problem is goose egg hunting is completely undramatic.
Yeah.
And then furthermore, conflict is the very essence of drama, and there's not allowed to be any of that either. But they don't want a documentary, they want a movie. And in the end, the solution is what the film became. I suddenly thought, what about we set the goose egg hunting in old times, do that in black and white, use that as the vehicle for the storytelling, and set the story in mythical times. Anyway, they embraced that very strongly, because they like all that jealousy stuff and, you know, all that sort of stuff, even though they said, you know, it'll be like that. They actually do really like it. And so that was a solution to everything. Do that stuff in colour, the main part of the story in colour. So you have some colour, some black and white. You have storytelling in it. You still are setting it all in old times or older than that. And it was just this wonderful sort of elegant solution to everything.
For those who haven't actually seen the film, the black and white sequences are what you're calling the old times. And in those sequences, you have a character telling a story, which we cut to in colour.
Yeah.
So you start off with an idea of how to make a film. Then comes the photos and the idea of that. How then do you sit down and write a script for a movie like this?
Well, for this one, it was a little different to most other things that I've done, because in this case, what was terribly important is that I did not impose what I wanted. I'm the means by which they tell their story or they make their film, except that I have to be the one to work out how to do it. Now, in terms of the script, I drew as much from them as I could in terms of parameters or anything specific or specific ideas. I read some Thompson stuff. There's another anthropologist who visited there earlier called Lloyd Warner. And I sort of worked at issues, you know. Okay, one of the things they wanted was ceremony. Ceremony is terribly important. Now, for me, ceremony, as you often do see it in films, is very difficult, because usually it stops the drama dead. And so what do you do in order not to stop the drama dead? And, you know, in the end, they wanted some ceremony, so it had to go in somewhere. And I'd read in Lloyd Warner about the death dance, and that's sort of what gave me that idea to, okay, well, we'll have that ceremony there, because then it can be quite dramatic. You know, if the lead character is dancing his own death dance, it's actually quite, whoa. It means something dramatically and in terms of character. Instead of it just being, you know, people dancing, you're thinking, okay, I've seen people dancing, so what? clearly in the past, the spiritual life was terribly important, you know, and sorcery, particularly in Lloyd Warner, kept coming up. And so I extracted bits from that and thinking, okay, well, that's something I have to deal with. But then there's other stuff that came from what they got excited about. There was a particular story of something that had happened, you know, maybe a decade before, that they kept telling and laughing about and think it was fantastically funny, which was these two guys who had killed the wrong person and hidden the body badly and got caught. That story amused them immensely, and they kept telling it to me, and I thought, okay, fine, I can find a way to put it in there. And so in the end, it all sort of fits together. You know, you meld it and mould it to make it work. Now, what I think was lucky for me is that what I had to do was tread a line between their form of storytelling and our form of storytelling, mm-hmm. and find a synthesis between the two so that it could work for both. You know, the danger is that it works for neither, but if you get it right, it works for both. And because their storytelling is so different to ours, because the whole structure of the language is different, they don't use conjunctions, and conjunctions, funnily enough, are the very basis of storytelling in our language. It's all cause and effect. And, you know, you don't have words like because and until and basic words like that that we use to tell stories. And so their stories are very meandering with incredible amount of repetition. And so the disparate elements that I had to find room for could be incorporated in quite a meandering way. And as long as it all connected up in the end, that was okay.
Now, it's when the film begins, you think you're in for something very kind of worthy, but you begin with a Star Wars joke and then very, very quickly move on to a fart joke. And the humour is what initially takes you by surprise.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is that, you know, in some way they wanted their own culture reflected. And they're actually very funny and they're quite robust with their humour and they laugh a lot. If in any way their culture was going to be reflected, then humour had to be part of it, really had to be part of it, because they are funny. That's how they live their lives. And so it was really a mantra of mine, if we can make it funny, then do, and don't forget to make it funny. Because the other thing that humour like that does is it humanises characters. And in particular, when you're dealing with, you know, in Australia, particularly Aboriginal people, you know, there's sort of a big, almost wall of silence between most Australians and Aboriginal people. And there's, you know, maybe they're seen as victims, or maybe they're seen as rogues, or worse, but they're never really seen as people. Mm. And so the humour helps a lot to see them as people. In the storytelling by David Gulp a little, I knew David was going to do it by the time I got to write it. And I know David, and I know the way he tells stories, and I know the way he plays with people, in a way, and when he tells his stories. And sometimes he plays with them, not just storytelling, but he's got a bit of a finger missing. And he'll have you on for days about that finger, you know, whether it's been taken by a croc or whether it's been cut off by an axe, and you never know the truth. So it was really good to be able to write for David, knowing his sense of humour and the way he tells stories. But also I think it was terribly important to say at the beginning, which, because there's this quite a serious bit that comes straight after that first joke, but to let people know beforehand they're allowed to laugh.
Yeah.
And this is not all going to be serious, although some of it is. Mm. And when I wrote that, I didn't actually know it was a Star Wars joke. It seemed to me to be a linguistic joke, but yes, it turns out that it is a Star Wars joke, and that's fine by me. It works just as well. I don't have a problem with that at all. It's just that for an Indigenous person from North Central Arnhem Land to be saying that his tribal lore comes in the words, you know, once upon a time or in a land far, far away or whatever, is completely bizarre, because of course they don't speak like that. They don't tell stories like that. It's actually about storytelling. But as it turns out, it's also about Star Wars, and that's a form of storytelling, so that's fine.
Storytelling is central to the film, and it's a story about a story. I'm really interested in that process and the function storytelling has for you, because it seems to be connected to nature itself in a way, and you compare it to a tree several times through the movie.
Yeah. It was a great piece of luck in a way that one of the things they wanted in it was storytelling, because storytelling is so important to their culture. You know, their whole history is oral storytelling. Good storytelling is what making films is about. But the storytelling in this, apart from that business of having to be a synthesis of two different sorts of storytelling, and it actually performed a major function in my thinking as to how to get this film shot at all. And so for me, it was very lucky that it was there, because it allowed me to discover how to shoot this film. And I mean that in a very practical way. You go into a community like that, and after some days there, you realise the immensity of the task, because culturally, filmmaking is opposed to the whole way they live their lives. First of all, filmmaking is very hierarchical, and theirs is a completely consensus-based society. And this sort of hierarchy stuff doesn't exist, and they don't work that way. Secondly, filmmaking is very time and schedule-oriented. Now, their lives are the complete opposite. Their lives drift along with the seasons, which tell them where to go and what to eat. And time doesn't mean anything like it means to us, and certainly it doesn't mean anything like be up at this time to do this. And so, you know, I felt, how are we going to do this? And I know what's going to happen. There are days when they're simply not going to turn up, or half of them will turn up and the other half won't. Or that somebody will die somewhere else and they'll all want to go off to a funeral and they'll disappear for 2 weeks. You know, how am I going to deal with this? So, knowing beforehand there are going to be major disruptions, I thought of this way of dealing with it, which has very much to do with the storyteller in this particular film, the storytelling, and also has very much to do with the nature and the spirit of the people. Okay, what they say are things like, I am the land is me. Mm-hmm. Now, they mean that in a way that we can't even begin to fathom. It's the closest I would put to it is they mean that literally, okay, that those two things are the same thing. Now, if we're trying to imagine that, we can't, so obviously it's not exactly what they mean, but that's the closest thing I can come to. And it is such a consistent thing, Indigenous people in Australia, all over Australia, their connection with land, their connection with country. It's intense. And you know, I think it's physical. I think it's the magnetic bloody field of the earth, and they sense exactly where they should be through that, and they're still more sensitive to it than we are. And so, putting those two things together, I thought, okay, this is what we'll do. Okay, let's imagine we've got this day, we're scheduled to shoot this particular scene, and nobody turns up. I'll say to Jonesy, who's the cameraman, I'll say, Jonesy, go into the swamp and get me two great shots. That's all I want, two great shots. I don't care what they are, as long as they're great shots. Off you go, bye-bye. He comes back lunchtime, and by then, some of the cast have turned up, okay, or all of the cast have turned up. Now, instead of then trying to shoot that whole scene that was scheduled for the day, you shoot only the second half, because you're scheduled to shoot the second half after lunch. Uh-huh. And you put one of Jones's great shots in where the first half is meant to be, and transition it with the storytelling. So, that way I can stick to the schedule, okay? But that way they can work to their schedule. I can still finish this thing on time somehow and be contributing to the film at the same time, because a great shot in the swamp is representing their complete sensibility of the people, and transition with storytelling is completely representing the way they do think, they tell stories, you know? And so this was my sort of solution to the practicalities of how to make a film here. And it largely worked very well.
There's a moment in it where it really kind of struck me in terms of storytelling as a writer and as a filmmaker, okay? And it's where they're all giving their versions of what they think has happened.
Yeah.
But you choose to actually show those versions and film those versions.
Yep, the speculative footage, yep.
Yeah, yeah, and it kind of reminded me of Hitchcock. I think in one of his earliest films, he shot a version of a scenario that someone had narrated, and the audience felt cheated because it turned out it didn't actually happen in the end. And he never did it again. It was always, you can't cheat the audience, mm-hmm. because you're actually showing them, when they see it happen, it's as if it has happened.
Yes.
And that's kind of how it felt in that scene as well. It was like, when you see all the different versions, it's almost as if they have created it through their storytelling.
First comment, I guess, on that is, because there are a number of them that come one after another, and they're quite short, you don't form as an audience the same sort of judgment as you're talking about Hitchcock, and it's probably a more complex sequence, and there's only one of them. And so these become what they are, which are speculations. It came to me through lots of things, but really it was through the storytelling that, that I heard from David and other people and up there and so on. Okay, their storytelling weaves a different sort of web than ours does. Okay, and they drift off with this stuff. And I could just imagine them imagining the storytelling. Because everything sort of relies on storytelling. It somehow, by showing it, it was more accurate than simply talking about it, because it was more how it's felt, how it's taken in. The constant repetition in their storytelling, because of no conjunctions and everything else, you know. And what they do is they say something and they add a bit and leave something off the beginning, and they add a bit more and leave something off, you know. It's like, you know, you see that man. You see that man there near that tree. That man there near that tree is sitting on that rock. Well, that man sitting on that rock near that tree, okay, I can't do it properly, but that's sort of what it's like. And it's sort of, you know, and you do, you see it, you know, because in the end it's repeated and added to, and slowly the picture builds up, and then the man gets up and moves, and you know, you see it. And so I thought it was a really accurate representation of what storytelling does. And also that sort of consensus way that they run things means that they, and I've seen it happen, they fully consider all sides of things, and it's almost like you've got to see it to fully consider it.
Now, obviously, as a writer, this was kind of quite different from the film you would normally write, I think. But can you talk about your normal writing process on a film?
Yeah, even that varies enormously.
Yeah.
Because some scripts take me a very long amount of time and some don't. And there's no perceptible difference between the two in a lot of ways. I steer clear of anything to do with the keyboard. Anything to do with the keyboard is perhaps the last 10% of the process. And sometimes even much less than 10%, but only 5%. And, you know, I've been doing it this way for years. And I used to write with a keyboard, and it was like this incredibly difficult thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you sit there and you force your way through, and it's just horrible. Now I work with a pencil and a rubber and index cards,
okay,
and a wall of kainite, which is sort of soft, sort of noseboard type substance, and pins with coloured heads, quite thick coloured heads, so you can pull them in and out very easily. The mechanics are very important to me, because if the mechanics aren't easy, then you stuff around a lot. Because I do a lot of moving of these cards, and I quite like the fact that I've filled up this section such that I want to put one more scene in there and there's no room. I have to move 40 cards by one. Okay, and to move those 40 cards by one is really an important process. Because you look at each card as you move it, and you sort of half see it, and you get to know the script better, and it's a little reward, a little break of, you know. And I tend to work in a sort of mosaic, and, you know, I might start with one idea. Okay, so I have an image in my head. A man alone in a wheat field, and he's scared. So I write that down on the card. All right, you know, exterior, wheat field, day. And then I always leave a bit of room for characters, but this stage is only a man. So the man I write, and I think this is the lead character for sure. Yeah. He stands alone in the wheat field, scared. And then I start to put it up on the board, which is divided into three to sort of vaguely, I mean, I don't read any of that sort of structural stuff, and I never have, but I've been made aware by people who say, well, where's your first act, and where's your second act, the bullshit that they talk. So it's divided up into three, acts one, two, and three, come on, there it is. And I think, okay, where do I put this? Because it could be the beginning, could be the middle, could be the end, could be anywhere. Okay, and so in the end I might put it at the end of act two, very last thing in act two, there it goes. And I think, okay, now, why is he scared? Who is he? And I start to ask questions. And that will give me ideas. Mm-hmm. Okay, and suddenly I've moved that card over to the end of Act 1 because I realise that the guts of the story is after this point. There's lots of stuff going to happen. And I've just got to get to that point, introduce him and get him to that point. And very slowly it starts to fill. And it might be scattered. My space is very important to me, where I work, and, you know, that the rubber is good and the pencil is good and that there's plenty of cards. Mm-hmm. I tend to try and work regular hours, like, you know, 4 in the morning till 8 in the morning, because then I can do another full day's work, you know, in the office or whatever, and at least I've had a good half day's writing, and it's the best part of the day anyway. And I might look at that board the entire session and nothing changes, or one card gets moved, or something happens and it's like 20 cards go up, you know, goes mad. Sometimes I put, and each card ends up being a scene, and I tend to think in scenes, but not always, you know. It might be that I write the chase, because that's all I know at this point. There's got to be a chase here, so up it goes. Okay? And then I don't know what the chase is yet. But then I'm working over here somewhere, I'm looking at that, and I sort of graze, you know, and then suddenly something will hit me, and I'll go over here, I'll go over here, I'll get all excited. But I might be looking at something over there, and suddenly the chase. It's got to be the tractor, and the harvester, and the truck, you know. And so away I go, and this one card, the chase, suddenly becomes 20 scenes.
Yeah.
And up they go, and other cards have to be moved, and all that sort of stuff. And there's a frenzy happens. Sometimes I put a card up there, because there's this scene, and there's that scene, and they're next to each other, and it doesn't feel right. And you think, oh, I know why. There's got to be something in between. So I move that one along and I put a card in there that simply says, I need a scene here. And then one day it'll come to me what that should be, because I need to introduce that he can't drive, and that's the place to do it, because then he can't get into the harvester and run away or whatever it is, you know, and there's the perfect spot for it. Yeah, and so that's generally how it goes. That's the roughest, quick, brief outline verbally that I can give you.
And then you said the last 10% is the actual
scene. I think of lines of dialogue. Uh-huh. They go up there. Sometimes the whole scene, the whole scene in complete execution goes up there, word for word, because that's what I feel I can contribute at that moment to that script. And you see, it doesn't matter, because I'm all over the place, and I don't get jammed with anything. You know, I might not do anything for a while, but I don't get jammed, where I have to force my way through this next scene before I can do anything else, because I can do something later. That's easy. Or I think of a line of dialogue for here, or you know, an interchange over here. And so the typing out of the script, most of it has been done, including dialogue and everything else. And it's a very quick, easy process. And there might be one thing left. You know, I need a scene here that I don't have. But by the time I've typed to that point, either it just comes easily, because you know exactly where you have to go from there, or it's this one little thing that you have to push through, and you know it's not quite adequate yet, but that's okay, because in the run of the whole thing, nobody will really pick it, and it'll be very easy to change later on without upsetting anything else. And so, for me, that whole thing has worked so much, because you read the film, you begin to read more and more of the film every time, you know, usually what I do when you know you get up at 4 a.m, and you know the cup of tea is going, and then you start and you think, okay, first thing I do is read the film so far, okay, and what I've got so far. Uh-huh. And so you read it every day, you read the whole film, so in the end you've worked it so fully, it's like many drafts in a way. And my first draft, or it could be somebody else's third draft minimum, and mostly, this is not a recommendation for anybody else until you know how to do it, mostly I shoot the first draft, because at the end of it, I mean I don't start doing that typing on the computer thing until it is the best that I can do. And if everything is not yet completely right, it's not up there. I don't put stuff up there that I think I'm going to change later on. You know, if I think I'm going to change, like, what the fuck is it doing up there?
Yeah.
You know, it shouldn't be up there.
But you're inevitably going to change certain things in the script while you're filming, aren't you?
Sometimes more than at other times. Yeah. And it depends very much on the particular film and on the particular process that we're taking on that film, and on the actors that I'm working with, in particular those factors. Look, you know, The Quiet Room, I ended up storyboarding the whole film, and it was shot almost exactly according to storyboard, and not only script, but storyboard as well. And so that didn't change much at all. Other films, you know, yeah, that can change quite a bit. Mm. Ten Canoes was, I mean, there was almost no dialogue written. And so, you know, in a way, that formed quite a lot during the shooting rather than on the page. Mm-hmm. And also in the tracker, stuff was written during the shoot. When I realised that I couldn't shoot a particular scene, okay, there was a scene without dialogue which described certain action, and to shoot it would have taken me 2 or 3 days if there was no dialogue. Then you have to see the action completely. And so in the end, what I did to overcome that problem was I wrote a very long soliloquy pages of soliloquy, which I could do effectively in one shot. And around that soliloquy, you saw bits of action, and you understood finally what was happening. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have to see the whole action, because this guy was talking. It was a really important sort of soliloquy in a way, but it came a bit out of left field, but it was like this guy realising what was going to happen to him. He's trying to save himself by talking. And what he's saying is actually quite interesting and thematically linked to the film. And so, you know, that was quite a radical change during shooting to take account of the production problem.
In The Tracker, you seem to deal in archetypes. Your characters don't have names. They're called The Tracker, The Fanatic.
Well, they're only called that in the end credits.
Right. But I was interested in this notion of how you view your characters in terms of them being archetypal.
Yeah, it's different each time. Sometimes it's desperately dangerous for me to give the characters names, mm-hmm. depending on what it is that I'm writing. Sometimes I have to give them a name in order to be able to continue. Sometimes I can't go on until I know who's playing that role. Okay, so I get halfway through and I think, no, okay, I've got to stop now. I've got to know who's playing this role, because otherwise I can't write it in anymore. Sometimes it's really useful to know who's going to play the role. Sometimes a project starts and it's like I already know who's going to play it before I start writing it, who has to play it. And so it really works very differently each time in that sense. Right. Now, with The Tracker, for example, I started off not wanting to know their names, and that I could call them these archetypes to remind me on the way through about aspects of who they were, you know, to form a character in an archetypal way. You know, in the end, and I shouldn't have put the names of those archetypes in the end credits. Right. Because now people refer to them as if they are part of the film, and they're not. And they're just characters, they're just people, and because they don't happen to call each other by name, you know, then people seek those end credits, and that's who they become when they're being discussed, and they're not. It's funny how you can get things wrong about the writing of the film in the end credits, you know. Names are really interesting, you know, that sometimes I really can't go a lot further until I know what this character is called. Because we attach things to names, to people we know, and so on, it's a really tricky area. And that's why sometimes people don't have names, you know. Mm. For me, it's the girl, the parents, the mother, the father. And in a sense, that's archetypes. But they're individual characters, and the actors will individualise them as well. But sometimes it's useful. Alexander's Project, it was useful, you know. Steve I knew somehow, and I knew Gary Sweet was going to play that character, because lots of reasons. But you know, in the first few days of fiddling with it, I had to find her name, and once I did, I was comfortable, I could keep going. So yeah, it's a really interesting area. And you know, sometimes I'll be doing other bits and pieces while I'm still trying to work out what their names are, because I know I will need names here.
Now, Tenkanu's, it's out at the moment, but you have another film that's already cut and is coming out quite soon.
I don't know when it's coming out, but it's almost complete. Okay. I mean, it's had one screening, but that was with live music, because we don't have a print yet that has the full soundtrack on it. It's a thing called Dr. Plonk, and it's a silent comedy in the tradition of Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin, you know, Keystone Cops sort of stuff. And we shot with a hand-cranked camera, and it was a lot of fun. It's wonderful.
Is it feature-length?
Oh, yeah.
Very different in character from Tenkanu's as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What gave you the idea for that?
Well, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. Okay, I was in the mix of Tenkanu's, and Tenkanu's had taken 2.5 years instead of, you know, 12 months. And the budget's the same. You earn the same amount of money in 2.5 years as you would earn in 12 months. And so we were heading back down the road of penury. And so I knew I had to do something very quickly after. And during the mix, I was trying to think what to do. Now, you know, I love mixing. You know, and I love working with Jim Curry, who's the sound recordist mixer, and you know, some of the best times on any film is over sound mix. And anyway, we finished the mix, and Jim and I were going to have, you know, a glass of red to celebrate. I said to Jim, you open the red, and I'll just go into the storeroom and try and find some mosquito repellent, because I was due to take a DVD with the mix of Tenkanu's on it up to the community to show them. And I heard the mosquitoes were pretty bad up there at that time of the year, so, you know, I went looking for the mosquito repellent. and I couldn't find it in the storeroom. And there's an old fridge in there, and I hadn't opened it for years, and I opened it up, and in there is 20,000 feet of old raw film stock, 35mm, and some of it is like 10 years out of date. And I look at it, and I just imagined that stock, what it might be like and what it would do, and I went, ha, I know what we're doing next. Because the only thing that I could think of that you could use this stock for is a silent comedy in the tradition of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, because we're used to receiving those films with massive imperfections. And so I wandered back round and said to Jim, Jim, cheers, I'm sorry, you're not working on the next film. And he went, what, what? I said, it's a silent comedy. And it was.
Excellent. Okay, thank you for talking to Shooting People about Ten Canoes and about Dr. Plonk. I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out. And about your writing with us as well. It's been really fascinating.
Great.
And I hope Ten Canoes does really, really well. It's a beautiful film and already getting prizes.
Yes.
So
yes.
I hope it goes on and is very successful.
Thank you.
So that's the end of another Shooting Screenwriters podcast. A big thank you to Rob Dehier for spending an hour with me, and to Lucy Fleet at The Works for setting everything up, and as always, to shooter Dan Squire, who performed absolute miracles with the audio. You can find out more about Rolf's films at his website, which is www.vertigoproductions.com.au. If you enjoyed this podcast or want to talk about it, then please just drop an email into the Screenwriters Network bulletin. We're always glad to hear from you. Until next time, thank you for listening.